Welcome to The Gauge, a podcast brought to you by Greengage, the first fully integrated financial services group, bridging the traditional financial services space with the new digital innovations in crypto assets and blockchain. In this series, we gauge expert opinion on the latest tech trends and plan to bring you a measured approach to discussing key developments in the world of blockchain and digital assets. In this episode of The Gauge, our host Sean Kiernan interviews Tom Spiller, OBE Lead Legal Director at Rosenblatt. Tom shares his expertise in law and his passion for politics, discussing the current developments in the UK's legal and policy world. They delve into topics such as the Financial Services and Markets Act, the Electronic Trade Documents Act, the Financial Promotions Regime for Crypto, Law Commission proposals, and FCA consultations. Tom emphasises the growing impact and importance of law and regulation of crypto assets, with industry professionals and regulators taking them far more seriously than in the past.
Welcome to another episode of The Gauge. I'm absolutely delighted to have Tom Spiller, OBE, who's the Lead Legal Director at Rosenblatt, here with us today. Tom is an expert in his field, and I have quite a few questions with him on not just the law itself, which is his profession, but also in the world of politics, which is his passion. To kick off, Tom, great to have you with us.
Sean, thank you very much for inviting me to be on the podcast.
There seems to be a lot happening all at once in the UK's legal and policy world. Largely exciting. What do you get when you cross the FSMA, or Financial Services Markets Act, Electronic Trade Documents Act, FinProm, or Financial Promotions, the Law Commission proposals, FCA consultations, etc.? How do you see this all stitching together?
That is the $24 billion question, Sean. When you started off, it kind of sounded like a why did the chicken cross the road type joke. So I'm glad it ended up with a question within my expertise. What do you get? Well, I mean, the sky's the limit, really. Three thoughts immediately spring to mind. I mean, first and foremost, you get the indisputable end of crypto's wild youth, in this country at least. They're now regulated by, lawyers refer to it as FSMA, and the various regulators that are so important in this country, particularly in terms of financial services, are taking crypto very seriously. And a really significant amount of effort has been put in. If you go to industry events, you don't see crypto bros in their pajamas. You see ex-bankers who've performed control functions, and often people who've been at the FCA, we'll come on to that later, and the Bank of England. And no one can say that crypto isn't serious anymore. I think it's a real epoch-defining moment. I think the second thing you get is real solid proof that the government in this country is genuinely serious about turning the UK into a global hub of blockchain technology. And this isn't happening by accident. The various pieces of legislation and regulation that you mentioned are all the culmination of an enormous amount of consulting, engagement, and the involvement of people from all manner of professions and institutions, be it government or industry, or lawyers, people from professional services backgrounds. And you can see that with, in particular, the Prime Minister's speech at FinTech Week, at which he was very proud to announce that A16Z were moving to the UK and their incubation project that would be here as well. That, to me, is just an enormous sort of sigh of relief that actually the words were backed up with intent, and slowly we're seeing this all come to fruition. And I think that the third thing, from my sort of a more narrow legal perspective, that it means is the real and genuine tangible, the word tangible is appropriate, when we're talking about digital objects, is the tangible opening of the door to tokenized real world assets. Now, there's been a lot of talk about this sort of thing for years now. But to be honest, from my seat in a law firm, it has been legally illiterate. I mean, the elephant in the room with all these conversations has been that, sure, you can have the token, it can be easily transferable on a ledger, and it can have all those benefits that the blockchain has inherent within it. But, the first day of law school, they teach you the various different legal methods of transferring different kinds of assets. And there was no meeting of, the vision, if I can use a cliche, of those who were touting real world assets and the actual black letter law by which you would achieve it. There is no mistake in the fact, it is no coincidence that Law Commission's proposals for a new category of law which specifically recognises digital objects comes at the same time as their reform of electronic trade documents. I mean, for the real world assets vision to be realised, you have to sift through and sort of sand off the various bits of our enormous statute book, or the statute book of any country in the world, to remove these parts of it, in where enshrined into law is the fact that there has to be a physical document, or, you know, a recording in a physical, you know, company book or something like that. So the Electronic Trade Documents Act is just, you know, as it's frequently referred to, the most important law you've never heard of. It is the canary down the mine. I can't think of another cliche. It's the leader of the pack, Sean. But it would appear to be the first sort of point at which we can actually start to move into a world where real tokenized real world assets are a real possibility. And of course, within that is inherent the fact that, you know, there are the removal of so many frictions in the process of transferring assets, which, you know, for you and I, I'm sure it would seem to be a very good thing and potentially turbocharge the economy. And I would just say, as a sort of final point on this, it would appear that slow and steady could potentially win the race. For years, people in this country, in the industry, have been lamenting that the slow pace of the various government entities that have been involved in this legislative process, be it Treasury, be it the judiciary, be it, you know, the FCA. Well, I can't imagine anyone would have an unkind word to say about the FCA. I'm sure you can't either. He's laughing, folks. And yeah, it would seem the slow, steady, gradual approach is having a good effect and potentially better than its alternatives. And I'm sure we'll come on to talk about the different approaches different countries have taken.
That's a remarkable kind of précis. I think, well done. One thing that I've clocked is there has to be a brooding intelligence somewhere for this all to come together. And I think you're spot on with the Electronic Documents Act. Like, this is something that is fundamental to making any of the change possible. I've seen Lord Holmes as one of the rare individuals that often speaks publicly about FISMA and, say, the Electronic Documents Act. Where is this brooding intelligence sitting that's kind of creating this? Is this someone in Whitehall, Treasury, the Cabinet Office? Where do you think this sits, this visionary?
Perhaps it's a hive mind, Sean, although I do suspect it does exist in London, you know, sadly or not. I think it's an enormous question to answer, but I suppose I'd just take one step back or zoom out, as they say, and say, I think at a very early stage in this process, it was the combination of two things really combined to spark this process that has led us to where we are today. I think first, the UK's relative predominance in both international law, but also financial services, and also a predominance specifically within what's loosely referred to as fintech. I think there's the stats, although this is less precise than I'd like it to be, but I think that the stat is that 70% of cases last year in the High Court, the commercial court specifically, did involve international commerce or an international party. 70%, you know, and I think it's higher in terms of the law under which most interstate international contracts are based. I think it's something like 80%. And really, you know, the second place is quite far away from where we are. So obviously, there's an enormous amount of interest, be it in the legal sector in London, be it within government or the judiciary, in maintaining that predominance. So there was a body formed in around 2020, the UK Joint Task Force, whose sole goal was to maintain that predominance. And, you know, the master of the roles, the most senior judge in this country, Geoffrey Voss, has been really, really strident in talking about his ambition to get the good cases over here. And to do that, you have to have industry participants. And that's where I think that ambition coincided with the Treasury's desire to keep London at its position as one of the all-time front runners in the world of finance. And of course, the fintech sector is an enormous part of our economy. It's somewhere where we lead, you know, most countries in the world. And I'm sure we'd like it to stay that way. So I think that's the intersection of it. Plus, the power and intellect of our financial services industry and the legal industry as well. And, you know, our legislative process is extremely good. It allows for the engagement of just an enormous, a really significant number of interested parties, you know, including some of our friends in industry and their representative bodies that engage with Parliament, such as the UK Crypto Asset Business Council, and of course our friends at Crypto UK. It would seem to be something that is now part of the furniture. I think that there are, I keep on telling people this, you know, stop me if I told you this before, Sean, but I watched a fantastic where there was someone from, as a young man from Treasury, who was talking about how he was a crypto advocate and how he had an unhosted wallet and how, you know, our approach to regulation should not be any different just because something is unhosted or hosted. And that sort of thing, to me, is now, you know, fully ingrained in the process. I see just a large number of cringing, I'm going to use the word stakeholders, you know, broadly across London and particularly in government who are interested in seeing this happen.
Which is actually much healthier if you think that the hive mind, as you called it, is much more diversified than a brooding intelligence. And I think if we look at our friends, as you would call them, in the US, the process there for legislation is a little bit more convoluted, and we've seen progress already in the UK on a few key matters. Who actually wrote the FSMA, as we're calling it, Ben? Is this an individual or a team? How would you maybe open the doors to understanding? Yeah.
Well, it's a great strength of our system that no one person did. So the parliamentary process, don't worry, I'm not going to walk you through a sort of textbook sort of flow chart. But the process begins with politicians and civil servants deciding the priorities of the day and their objectives. And then quite often they'll instruct the good lawyers at the government legal service to produce draft legislation. This is all assuming it's backed by the government, which it was. But once draft legislation sort of hits Parliament, then anyone can have their say, really, be that any one of the 650 members of Parliament who can debate and suggest amendments to legislation. And then we go to committee, at which point all manner of people are brought in, experts, industry, you know, lobbying groups. And as I said, our process is extremely good because it benefits from so much input. And then, you know, the experts and people at that stage are picked by members of the House of Commons who follow a particular path and perhaps, you know, have a particular perspective based on their role within the parliamentary process. But the even better thing is that once it's done that, it goes up to the House of Lords. And obviously the House of Lords, different demographic, different profile, different position, different political perspective. And then they call in the experts that they think are necessary. And, you know, I'm sure I sound like a broken record, but there's just an enormous amount of input that's possible to come up with the actual words that end up printed in the statute book. And it's a beautiful thing.
One could almost draw a parallel to open source code, if you will. But
you've never been to the House of Lords, have
you? No, I haven't. I'm not at legs. The Parliament's potentially changing. We've seen a long run of Tories in power and Labour's nipping at the heels right now. Do you think that a change in power would have a big influence on the stated ambition for the UK to be a crypto asset hub?
Okay, well, on the basis of my personal politics, which are a matter of public record, I would just say that, you know, I'm sure the government will change party at some point in the future, though we don't know when. But I'd be really surprised if a future Labour government chose to derail this process that's now in motion. And, you know, my view is it would be extremely, extremely unwise for them to do so. I'm no expert in the criminology of the Labour Party. But I think the signs are good so far. I mean, the leader of the opposition has moved a young man called Darren Jones, who's widely perceived to be Labour's sort of technology spokesman and expert, into a Treasury role in his shadow cabinet that would suggest that he's going to go into a Treasury role which would deal with fintech and as part of that blockchain technology. So, you know, having had some brief conversations with Darren, he strikes me as an extremely sensible, non-tribal politician who's willing to be part of that process I outlined before and listen to all voices. And those of us who are old enough to remember when Jeremy Corbyn was in charge of the party wouldn't necessarily take that for granted. So it's a sigh of relief from me. I think realistically, also just another point on why I don't think the current process will be derailed. Government sits at the very top, at the executive, of this enormous sprawling machine of the civil service and its various agencies. And realistically, at any given moment, a government can only have a small number of strategic priorities and focus on them. So it's not the case that everything that came before, everything that is motion, is torn up when government changes. Kind of the opposite, really. It's a laser-like focus on what's happening and how, if anything, it should be changed to focus and harness sort of different political objectives. So far, the politics of blockchain appears to be pretty predictable and relatively cross-party. You know, there are the age-old arguments of innovation versus safety, which of course are cliches. It's much more nuanced than that, but that's it. And of course, I remember the detailed, in-depth work that Greengage did itself on the amount of knowledge in Parliament about blockchain, and it's relatively low. So I can't see politicians in this sort of risk-averse era that we're in now wanting to wade into an industry that perhaps don't know much about to try and derail something that's potentially going to bring enormous benefits to our financial services, our legal sector, and, you know, our position at the front of emerging technologies. So I would hope the future is bright. Let's see.
I mean, I would tend to agree. And thank you again for the elucidation of how you would approach that. One area that we've been mindful to support, obviously, is education, and also opening the tent a bit further to let more new entrants in. Innovation and competition are now secondary objectives for the FCA under the FISMA. Do you think this opening up secondary objectives will actually lead to positive outcomes for new entrants and competition? Or is this something that we need to watch a little bit closer?
Yes, it's a very diplomatic question, sure. The elephant in the room is all those unkind things that people say at industry events about the FCA and the frustrations that have, you know, bubbled up as a result of the slow and steady approach that's been taken. It is so funny, that's the best word I can think of, to get an international perspective on how the FCA is perceived. They're perceived as extremely innovative, forward-thinking financial regulators, you know, on the basis of their practice of sandboxes, on the basis of outcomes-based regulation. We take that all for granted in this country, but the alternatives are much worse and more frustrating, believe you me. I think the criticism of the FCA in the past has been, I think if you sort of, you know, pare it back and then sort of look to the heart of it, it is based on a frustration of a lack of bandwidth. And, you know, that's probably caused by poaching, by industry. So that is an interesting little enigma. I mean, I can predictions are hard, especially when they're about the future, but I can see two paths open to the FCA now that they have these secondary objectives. I mean, the first could be not to change, business as usual, and just carry on and wait for the political capital prod to come, if it does. And the second could be obviously balancing their obligations of public safety and market regulation and all those sorts of objectives of yesterday with these new objectives, and, you know, come out with a more permissive approach, which will lean heavily on, again, political guidance from government and politicians of the day. And I suppose whether or not the government's fintech strategy changes as well, that is possible. But in this country, we do tend to have long-term strategies set by the civil service and then interventions by the ministers of the day on a more day-to-day basis. So I can't see a wholesale change in that in the future. But whatever iteration it's ever in, the Treasury in particular, the FCA, they are not the most innovative of places. Perhaps that's inherent in what they do. But I am optimistic, I have to say. And I'm sure we're all eager to get a view from our friends at the FCA on how they see this playing out, because many variables are possible.
Yeah, I think collaboration will be key. We've seen, again, from the US that the SEC's practice of regulation through enforcement is an interesting approach, to say the least. I was surprised to hear, actually, that industry, if there was a survey, actually seems to find this as a positive approach, as opposed to the opposite route, which would be regulation through statutory outlining of perimeter, which I think one negative, at least the perception could be, is that that is a little bit more restrictive than a nuanced approach, which regulatory enforcement perhaps gives. There's pros and cons, obviously. But I think with the UK, we're at least in with a chance with common law and the capacity for consultation to have a more dynamic and nuanced approach. In practice, we'll see. I'd be curious to hear your views on the international spectrum. I know you're looking at not just the UK and the US, but further afield. Is there anywhere we should be watching more closely for innovation?
Yeah, it's really interesting, isn't it? The things you take for granted. I mean, regulation by enforcement versus, you know, law then regulation. It's a really contrasting approach from two countries that have a lot in common and a shared history. So how funny that it should be so divergent. I mean, regulation by enforcement is sort of, you know, legal terrorism, effectively. You cannot plan your business. How could you possibly plan your business, know who you're going to be, how many people you need to hire, where to deploy capital in circumstances where you exist in a legal vacuum and you could be shut down the next day? I've spoken to people at top 10 L1 chain labs where they just have no idea what to do or whether or not they should leave America. And I can fully understand that. Who wants to exist in that level of uncertainty? Business demands certainty. And that is why perhaps the common law is so popular at an international level from people who are picking the law of the contracts they want to do business under. I think it more broadly internationally, that there is, of course, the regulation by enforcement approach. There is also the slow and thing that the approach that I've termed slow and steady, which you can see in really sophisticated countries such as Japan, such as South Korea, such as Singapore. And it's no surprise that these major economies are doing so well in terms of crypto adoption, in terms of national champions that they have. I mean, it's in this country, it's largely, the charge has largely been led by Treasury. But the South Korean example is very instructive because the charge is largely led by their tax authorities. And you can see how, I mean, their approach was, okay, you're all doing business, you're doing something new, it's making money, have you paid tax on it? And anyone who was not able to give full and frank details was shut down. And, you know, in one sense, that's very restrictive. In another, they've got a squeaky clean, hyper-professional sector. You know, when I referred earlier to the end of the wild youth of crypto in this country, that has to be a good thing. You know, the restrictive tightening that has been put in place by the FCA has filtered out the chaff. I'm not going to say something more controversial about the people who were sort of in out of the FCA authorized list, but we all know what I'm talking about. It's very interesting to me. I mean, it's no surprise that the Southeast Asian countries, who are so forward when it comes to different payment methods, innovation in terms of technology and software in particular, are major adopters, and they have also adopted the law then regulation approach. I mean, one really interesting feature when looking internationally that I found is that it's regulation by enforcement, there's law then regulation, but there's also lawlessness. And, you know, it's probably time to say the emperor's got no clothes when it comes to Hong Kong. People waxing lyrical about their fantastic regulation, but how can you have regulation where there's no rule of law? You don't have to be a mind reader to look at the trajectory of the politics of China and the behavior of its state to think maybe setting up here is not such a good idea. It would seem to me to be fairly obvious that there is that extra category of countries, you know, within the crypto sphere that perhaps aren't all they're cracked up to be. And yeah, it's a very varied and interesting picture when you look internationally, Sean.
And longevity is a big thing, I think, being able to plan a business for a long time. I also was keen to hear your thoughts, and this will be my final question, on the areas that you're most excited about. Like, what are some of the things that you're watching closely and are keen to see how it unfolds?
Yeah, I mean, there's so much, isn't there? That's an enormous question. So you and I, and maybe most people who listen to this podcast, see blockchain mainly through the financial services perspective. And, you know, I think we've spoken in the past about a case involving, shall we say, an innovative form of trading equities that resulted in some tax investigations I my firm have been involved with recently, that there wouldn't be any gray area. There wouldn't have been any, you know, alleged malpractice had equities been NFTs on the blockchain. You and I both know about the enormous inefficiencies that exist within our financial services sector, even though we are in London, one of the leading centers of excellence in the world. And, you know, the promise of disintermediation and potentially 24-hour, you know, operation of markets, the tokenization of bank deposits, as we've seen in the Far East, like that's all very, very exciting, as is the potential impact of blockchain for identity purposes and record keeping and the impact that would have on the NHS. One example I wanted to mention when we talked about real world assets is this idea, I don't know, have you seen, we've all been really excited about potentially putting the land registry in this country on the blockchain. I mean, I don't think that will ever happen, right? But that, wouldn't that be great? There's been a fudge in America. I don't know if you saw this. There's a company who's been selling houses represented by NFTs. I thought, wow, that's incredible. I can't believe the Americans have done it already. But, you know, funnily enough, when I read a bit more into it, they had to create an SPV. The SPV owned the house, and then the NFT represents the one share of the SPV. So alongside this blockchain, the smart contract for the NFT, there sits a really massive contract written by lawyers, hundreds of pages long. And can you imagine getting all the, or a significant part of the real estate assets of this country into an SPV, the tax consequences that would cause? We are absolutely ludicrous. But anyway, I'm diverging just for my cool example. But I would say, you know, identity, the idea of solving, you know, the zero knowledge proofs that can really potentially protect people against identity theft, that is very, very exciting to me. A lot of cases that come across my desk are fraud based on information that's been obtained from one place or another on the internet. And the future's bright.
Amazing. Watch this space. Thank you again, Tom.
Thanks, Sean.